This podcast is produced with support from Yakult.
What does the future hold for microbial research? In the past decade, there's been an explosion of interest in the trillions of microbes that live on us and in us, and the roles they may play in nutrition, in disease, in cancers, and even in brain development. The goal of many scientists is to understand the microbiota better, so that we can harness it to improve human health. But how will we get there, and what will some of the challenges be? I'm Anand Jagatia, and joining me on the line to discuss these issues are three researchers on the cutting edge of the discipline.
Hi, my name is Rochelle Hates, and I'm a neuroscientist. I work at the Karolinska Institute, and we're particularly interested to understand the role of the human gut microbiota on early aspects of brain development and behavior, and in particular, neurobehavioral outcomes implicated in the pathophysiology of autism spectrum disorder.
Hi, my name is Oran Elinav. I'm a professor at the Weizmann Institute of Science in Israel, and we're trying to decode the alphabet that composes the language by which we and our internal microbes, commensal microbes, communicate in health, and to understand what happens when this language, when this crosstalk is perturbed, that leads to the development of a variety of common multifactorial diseases.
Hello, my name is Jennifer Wargo. I'm at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. I'm a surgeon scientist, and my group and I study the role of intratumoral bacteria as well as the role of the gut microbiota in response to immunotherapy.
So my first question is about moving from correlation to causation. There have been plenty of association studies over the years that have linked the composition of a microbiota to certain health outcomes. But what we really want to do is find out whether microbes are actually causing or driving disease. So I wanted to ask you, how are we going to get there? Iran, shall we start with you?
Well, I think that the nice thing about the microbiome field that in a decade of very intense and growing effort, it has started to produce very exciting tools. For example, germ-free mice, they enable us to transfer whole microbiome configurations or distinct signatures of microbes or even single microbes from humans suffering of a particular disease into mice that don't harbor any microbiome of their own. And then we can actually model the human disease in the reduced mouse setting. And if we can recapitulate a human phenotype in these recipient mice, we can study them using many tools that are available in animal models in order to reach insights about the causality by which a given microbe or group of microbes in the human body contribute to disease.
Okay, so germ-free mice are potentially going to continue to be a really important tool. How else can we study causality?
In the last 2 or 3 years, we've gathered more technologies that enable us to further prove causality or to probe into mechanism. These include, for example, the development of what we call metabolomics that enables us for the first time to not only characterize the genomes of all the microbes that reside within different human microbiomes, but actually to characterize and quantify the tens of thousands of potentially bioactive small molecules that different human microbiomes secrete or modify. So these small molecules actually, in our view, constitute part of this elusive alphabet by which we and our microbes communicate with each other.
Right, so looking at these proteins, these metabolites, means that we can not only say who these microbes are, but also figure out what they're doing. Rochelle, is that something that your group has been looking into?
I certainly agree. I will only ask one thing. We have been taking the same approach, looking at the metabolites, trying to identify also those active products that actually can cross the blood-brain barrier. And we actually going now into using CSF samples, cerebrospinal fluid, to see if we can also detect in humans as well.
And Iran, you mentioned that these microbes could potentially be producing tens of thousands of bioactive molecules that we might want to study. So how on earth do you go about analyzing that much data?
That's a great question, because these actually include not only the thousands of metabolites that a given microbiome may generate or modify, but also a huge chunk of genomic data that represents the genomic code of the different microbial elements within the microbiome. So the way that we choose to try and simplify this really multi-factor equation is to develop new computational pipelines And using this computational machine learning and AI approaches, we are able to narrow down the list of potential drivers of disease coming from the microbiome in order to actually mechanistically study their potential function.
Jennifer, can I bring you in here?
Yeah, and I just wanted to echo now what we're trying to do is go beyond, this taxonomy, to look more at function, to do metabolic profiling within these patients, and also to do more work in the mouse models. So we work a lot with the germ-free mouse models. We're also looking at other factors that impact these gut microbes and how they may influence response to cancer treatment and overall immunity, such as the role of diet. In cancer patients, we find that if patients have a high-fiber diet, they actually have a more diverse microbiome and are much more likely to respond to immunotherapy. And in addition, we've looked at the use of over-the-counter probiotics, which has an interesting impact on the microbiota in our patients and also in our germ-free mouse models.
What are going to be some of the difficulties then in teasing out some of those relationships?
So I think a common question now is, what is the optimal consortia of microbes that can actually enhance responses, enhance overall immunity first, and then enhance responses to cancer immunotherapy? And I think we don't know the answer yet. And certainly there's a lot of trials underway, including trials using fecal transplant from complete responder patients being transplanted into patients who were going on to immunotherapy. And we have such a trial underway. I mean, I think we do need to standardize approaches for collection, for sequencing, and then ideally to develop databases that could be shared and so that we can learn, really from these global cohorts.
What I was wondering was whether now each of you could paint a picture of the future. So looking forward ahead, decades in the future, what kinds of things do we want to be able to do with this research and this knowledge? Rochelis, why don't we start with you? What are your hopes for the future?
Well, in terms of my own research, we recently discovered that components of the bacteria cell wall, they're able to translocate from the gut and cross the blood-brain barrier. So we are very much focusing on identifying those motifs. And what we would like to have in the future is like a microarray, and then we can actually screen our infants. Once that we identify, once we know the mechanisms, then we need to have tools for the clinicians to screen large populations, and then we can actually go into personalized medicine.
And Iran, I know that your personalized medicine and personalized nutrition, they're both things that, you're really interested in as well.
Yeah, we have found that the microbiome can represent a unique signature, which is unique to each individual, which can explain different traits of different individuals in health. We've recently proven this to be the case with personalized nutrition, in which we deeply examined a large cohort of human individuals and found that we can use data acquired from the microbiome together with other clinical data in order to accurately predict an individualized unique responses to any given food, which opened up the prospect of personalizing dietary approaches in contrast to the one-size-fits-all dietary modalities, which we know have not worked very well in 50 years of fighting the metabolic syndrome. The microbiome represents an extra genome, which in contrast to our human genome, is not only important, but is amenable to change and manipulation. We can use it diagnostically in order to personalize treatment and to personalize diagnostic, and we can try to find therapeutic targets in it. And this concept of personalization and the utilization of the microbiome, I think, would constitute a growing and exciting aspect of microbiome research in years to come.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, that idea of being able to, re-engineer or restore or kind of reconstitute somebody's microbiome so that it kind of, to make them healthier is really exciting. I mean, what are going to be some of the challenges that we need to kind of deal with now and in the coming years so that we can get to that stage one day?
I think that there are several challenges which we need to face. We need to improve our clinical trial capacities to larger trials and to include much more data collection and advanced technologies that would enable to analyze this big data, such as AI and machine learning. And this is a big challenge that we as a field need to face in terms of development of new experimental and computational techniques that would enable us to probe and to differentiate between the causative signals and the many noisy secondary signals which are of less importance.
And Jennifer, finally, what do you think that the future could hold with relation to cancer, and what's kind of stopping us from getting there one day?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think one challenge in the field is I think we don't know what is the perfect microbiome, you know, to either treat cancer or to prevent cancer. In addition to that, I think there is kind of an urgent need to really develop tools to be able to profile the microbiome and for patients with cancer relatively quickly, but that are reliable and that can be tested in large cohorts of patients. And then from a therapeutic aspect, again, I think, you know, Aran hit the nail on the head. I think we need to do better trials. I think we need to be rational about the different ways that we are manipulating the microbiome and use a scientific and rational approach to designing strategies to manipulate the microbiome. And then also to do this in larger cohorts in a collaborative way to collect large numbers of biospecimens so that these can be analyzed. And if we know why a patient responded or didn't respond, you know, and then I think another big question in the field is an optimal microbiome optimal for overall health and protection against all kinds of diseases, not only inflammatory bowel disease and neurodegenerative disease, but is there the perfect microbiome out there that could really restore optimal health? And, you know, I think that's a big question. I think, you know, if I were to think ahead and say, what is the future? You know, what could we look for in the future? So could you one day have an app on your smartphone or on your smartwatch that could actually tell you what your metabolic profile is, and which would be a reflection of your gut microbes, and could actually send you an alert to eat more fiber or modify your diet? Wouldn't that be interesting?
That sounds like a really incredible idea, and microbiota research in general and what it could offer us is something that's really captured the public's imagination. But there is also a lot of hype, and so I wanted to ask you what maybe some of the limitations of this research are. What are some of the things that it won't be able to do? Or what are some of the areas where we should be more cautious?
One area of hype is that the microbiome has really been embraced by really everyone as now something that's modifiable that you could change that could actually improve overall health. And so there are large efforts to do that, but they're not always rationally thought out. And so I think that there are a lot of people who want to go out there and change their own microbiome and do so by either buying over-the-counter probiotics or changing their diet in a drastic way. And they might actually be harming the microbes in their gut and actually negatively impacting their own health. Another aspect of the hype is that now there are all these trials looking at different ways to manipulate the microbes in order to treat disease. And I think, you know, we will see negative trials in this because not all of these trials are going to be perfect right off the bat. We don't know the answers yet. And I think the important thing is that we need to learn from those trials, not just when these negative trials start to get published or not published and presented, not just throw up our hands and say, it was all hype, this can't work.
Thanks, Jennifer. Aran, Rochelis, have either of you got anything to comment on in terms of hype?
I think that some of the hyper-hype is caused by irrational expectations of the microbiome curing or changing everything in human physiology. And we need to realize with the slow maturation of the field that the microbiome or components in the microbiome would probably be beneficial and would probably be found to regulate many important human body processes, but the microbiome is not going to do it all. And the human genome is extremely important. And really to get at the true potential of the microbiome and to get over this overhype, we need to transform the field from many aspects of what I call hand-waving into data-driven, science-driven, and mechanism-driven studies that would actually identify how components of the microbiome do what we think they're doing.
Yeah, and Rochelis, how about you? Have you got anything that you wanted to say?
Another point of view is that I get many phone calls from parents out there that they want to know the perfect probiotic for their kids that they have ADHD or autism, or even other patients with anxiety disorders. And I think that is one thing that we need to be aware that there is not going to be the probiotic or the perfect solution for all the psychiatric disorders. We have to take into consideration aspects like developmental changes that are going to take place, gender differences, the impact of diet, and so forth. So when we are thinking about therapeutics, it's not a trivial issue. And this is where I think we need to have our expectations more realistic, that this process will take more time than just 3 or 5 years, in my opinion, at least.
Could each of you maybe give me like one trend that really excites you and something that, you know, our listeners should kind of like keep an eye out on? Jennifer, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, I think, well, one area that really excites me is the role of the tumor microbiome. And I think early studies focused on bacteria, but now we know that viruses can play a major role in carcinogenesis and even response to therapy. And so I would keep my eye out for the microbiome and tumors as well. And could we develop vaccine strategies based on that information to actually prevent cancer?
Iran?
One point that probably would become more and more prominent in the microbiome field in years to come, which is the study of microbiomes other than the gut microbiome. The gut microbiome has been extensively studied, but there are other microbiomes that are equally interesting, such as the skin microbiome, the urogenital microbiome, the respiratory system microbiomes. And in each of these localities, the microbes have evolved to provide critical activities and functions to the relevant organ. And I think we will learn much more about these other microbiomes and their contribution to human health in years to come. And as well, we will learn about the contribution of microorganisms in these different microbiomes that are different than bacteria. The virome, the mycome, the parasites in the microbiome are probably very important and central, but are much understudied as compared to bacteria. And I expect that we will learn much more about the contribution of these other kingdoms to this really intriguing ecosystem in years to come.
Thanks, Aaron. And Rochelle, how about you? What are some things that we should look out for?
Something that excites me at the moment is actually the impact of diet, because there we can actually help and guide the patients. Another thing is that I think we need to make a global consortium and efforts, really. Perhaps it's an organization more at the international level to join these efforts and to really critically guide new clinical studies and translational studies into the field. That would be something that I would like to see.
Fantastic. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure talking to all of you. All that remains for me now to do is to thank each of you, Rochelle Heights, Iran Elenov, and Jennifer Wargo. I've been Anand Jagatia. Thank you so much for speaking with us.